bit tomorrow, but it's liberation from greed, hatred, delusion. That's central to the idea of liberation. But it's also liberation from a constrictive social role that has been imposed upon you, either by the caste system or by the pressures of, let's say, modern society. I mean, my mother certainly wanted me to become a doctor or a lawyer. Although she was terribly liberal, and she was in the same breath saying, but you know, you must do what you want, dear. The idea was that if she allowed that sort of freedom, then I would become a doctor or a lawyer. A Buddhist monk wasn't high up on her list of preferences. And she was very shocked when I became a Buddhist monk, because I took, you know, I valued and I'm very grateful for the liberal culture in which I grew up at home, but it didn't actually pay off in the way that my mother had wanted. So I don't think this notion of caste or class identity or role is actually so abolished in our world. I think it's still there as a pressure on people. I think there's a lot of economic pressure that, you know, I want to be an artist, but how am I going to earn a living? How am I going to get a good pension? And you'll be given those pressures, I mean, maybe the younger people amongst you at least. But even, you know, in midlife, we have a crisis. We don't really want to be a chartered accountant or whatever it is. So I do think we need to take the notion of self and the critique the Buddha gives of it into this realm of our social identity. I mean, we have if we don't believe in rebirth, I don't believe in rebirth, I just don't know, but I'm not going to take it for granted. How do we maximize how do we live most fully on this earth? How do we live, how do we flourish maximally and optimally in this life? To me, that's a very important question. Buddhism often doesn't really address that. In fact, with this whole no-self idea, it would seem to be a funny question to ask even. But as we'll see again a bit tomorrow, I think it's very much of the heart of the Buddha's vision to create a framework of seeing the world in which you are freed to flourish in a way that optimizes the capacity and the potential that you as a unique individual have. Now the other thing is, although the Buddha is clearly has no time for an essential self, something, an eternal essential self, that doesn't mean that we are not all utterly unique persons. And through our actions, I think what we do is refine our own uniqueness and distinctiveness. And I don't think that has to be seen in a purely egotistical way. I think that's what it means to, in a sense, flourish. So in other words, our uniqueness as persons is not due to the fact that we have some essential person, essential Stephen, in here somewhere that's different from the essential Aviv or the essential Molly. But our differences and our uniqueness arise out of the fact that the circumstances, the choices, the conditions that have given rise to this life are necessarily different and not comparable to the conditions that and choices that have given rise to your lives. That's where difference and distinctiveness emerges. But of course, such distinctiveness is not inherent, but it is the result of choices and acts. That's the important point. Now, what's interesting is that this idea of the ocean and dissolving into it is also found in the Upanishads. In other words, it's an ancient Indian metaphor. But look at how it's used in the Upanishads. This is from the Mundaka Upanishad. Just as the flowing rivers disappear into the ocean, losing their name and form, we looked at yesterday, losing their distinctive identity, thus the wise person, freed from name and form, freed from his identity, goes to the divine person, God, who is greater than the grave. Now, the Buddha, I think, is probably, we can't know for sure, but he's probably got this in mind. Now, what is different is that in the Upanishads, in Vedanta, the idea is that you lose your personal identity and dissolve into the greater identity of the divine, of God. Whereas in Buddhism, on the Buddha's version of this, you don't lose your personal identity, you lose your social identity. That's what he uses the metaphor to convey. That in the ocean of the Dhamma is one in which your social role, your the idea of who you are in society, that is what is dissolved, not your personal identity. I think that's a very telling point, frankly. But I would, wouldn't I? Otherwise I wouldn't have cited it. Let's look at another verse now that I think says the same thing in even more specific terms. This is from the... I don't have this... it's this little four-line verse about the farmer. It's actually Dhammapada verse 80, if you want to look it up. Dhammapada verse 80. Just as a farmer irrigates his field, just as a fletcher fashions an arrow, just as a carpenter shapes a piece of wood, so the sage or the wise person tames the self. Now, most translations say, so the sage tames himself, which is correct. But what really surprised me when I read this text in Pali, it was in a Pali for Dummies book I was studying. And again, I'm sorry to use grammatical terms, but the word self was in the accusative form. In other words, it was the direct object of the verb. It had exactly the same relationship to the sage as the field to the farmer, the arrow to the fletcher, the piece of wood to the carpenter. In other words, the Buddha is comparing atta, self, to a field, to an arrow, to a piece of wood. And in each case, when we look at how the metaphor works, these are things that can be transformed. The farmer irrigates the field. That's a metaphor for us irrigating ourselves. What do you do when you irrigate something? You allow it, you allow a field, which has up until then perhaps been barren and dry and without anything growing. By irrigating it, you enable things to grow. You can produce a crop. You can produce trees, grain, fruit, whatever you like. So this is it's a very earthy metaphor, and it's a metaphor of life. And water again. There's many water metaphors in Buddhism. Entering the stream is a good one. Pouring into the ocean. Irrigating the field. These are all water metaphors. And by contrast, Mara, the demonic, who's the sort of counter figure to the Buddha mythologically, is called Namuchi, which means the one who holds back the water, the one who blocks the water. Namuchi in Vedic times was the demon who prevented the monsoon from falling. And the Buddha, very often, instead of saying Mara, says Namuchi, which refers to the drought demon. So again, you have here a very clear use of a metaphor that suggests that what the Buddha is teaching is, in fact, a way of flourishing in life. It's not about, as much Theravada Buddhism tends to insist, about escaping from birth and death, escaping from the skandhas, escaping from the conditioned world. It's about learning to actually free yourself to flourish within the conditions of life. In the same way that a farmer irrigating a field is able to produce a crop, that a fletcher or an arrowsmith is able to put together different elements in order to create an arrow, which if you think about it is a metaphor
that heals.
Heals?
That kills.
Kills. Well, it does kill.
It's the opposite of the irrigation metaphor.
Yeah, it's true. But I think I would take it in a more pacific way of being able to be directed unerringly to its target. Let's think. A good arrow
may kill someone, it's true.
It's
but
meant to kill.
It's meant to, well, maybe, who knows. Anyway, let's take it the way that...
Arrow Cupid.
Brilliant, exactly. Yeah. The point to me, at least, in this metaphor, and all metaphors are going to be limited, inevitably. Don't take them literally. But basically, an arrow, if it's a well-designed arrow, will go directly to its target, or it can at least, if you fire it correctly. Now, to me, that's a metaphor of giving one's life a clear goal and heading unerringly towards it. It's about the realization of a purpose or a goal. Just as a carpenter shapes a piece of wood. Again, in a sense, the Buddha's saying that what we are like unfashioned blocks of wood, and that the practice is one in which we shape and fashion and form that piece of wood into something that then has value. We might turn it into a beam that we would use to make a house, or we might carve it into a bowl from which we can eat food, or we might make it into a beautiful statue that we can admire, or maybe it can be an icon of some kind. In other words, he very much sees his teaching not about a self-negation, but a self-creation. This is really what it's about. He's basically saying the practice is about creating yourself. And it's only a non-essential self that can be created. An essential self is already what it is forever. By abandoning the notion of an essential self, by abandoning the notion that the self in its deepest sense is actually identical with God, which again is a very, very beautiful idea, but it sort of turns attention to something transcendent and absolute, rather than to recognizing that who you are, yourself, your person, is something that is built into this, the fabric of a changing, often suffering, conflicting world. How do I shape and form myself in such a way that I can best realize my goals in this life?
Tame.
Well, that's the word he uses. It's dhammati in Pali, which is in fact a cognate. In other words, it has the same root as the English word tame. Dhammati, D-A-M. In English, tame, T-A-M. It's actually the same word. So this is an interesting metaphor, because what is it that we tame? We tame things that are out of control. Mm-hmm. We tame, let's say, a wild bull or a horse.
Monkey.
Monkey. Or whatever. Yeah, taming is about, in a sense, disciplining. It's about taking something. I mean, look at your mind when you meditate. All over the place, at least in my case. I doubt in yours. But when you start meditating, you become very aware that your mind is not tamed. That you try to tame it by saying, pay attention to the breath. And then 3 nanoseconds later, it's gone off on some sort of crazy story. That's a very good image, and of a monkey mind, as they use that in the Tibetan tradition. The mind is like a monkey that just won't stop jumping from one branch to the next. It's out of control. And one of the scary things we discover when we start meditating is that much of our life is out of control. We have the illusion of being in charge, of being the ruler of our body and mind. But when you look more closely, you realize that's kind of a fiction. But much of the time, we're really being ruled by often quite instinctive, chaotic, greedy, hateful, fearful emotions and instincts and impulses. And that's part of the, I think for many of us, the revelation, one of the revelations of meditation, of mindful awareness, is that we realize how out of control we are. Therefore, the practice, you know, sitting regularly, going on retreats, trying to think more systematically and clearly about these things, is a kind of taming. The word vinaya, I don't know if it means that in Pali, but in Tibetan, vinaya is called dulwa, which means taming. Same idea. The discipline, the practice, is a kind of taming. We would call it self-discipline, I suppose. Now,
what would it mean to tame the self, not consciousness or whatever?
Well, this is what I think is interesting, because it's basically, what's your name?
Svit.
It's about taming Svit. It's about taming Stephen. It's not about taming Stephen's consciousness. And that might be part of it. But that, I think, is what's interesting, is because he's not singling out some element of our experience, but he's actually saying this story that we are, this ongoing, evolving person, is what it need, is what we practice with. It's not, I mean, taming the mind is what you get a lot in Buddhism, but here we have taming the self. Taming oneself is perhaps easier to say it, but, and that's how the translators usually use it, but, and again to go into technical linguistic jargon, they make self a reflexive function of the verb rather than the direct object of the verb. I tame myself, as opposed to I tame the self, I tame me. This is clearly stated in the Pali. And again, Buddhists have a kind of aversion to the S word. They try not to use it, self, as though it's somehow toxic. But that, I think, is the legacy of certain aspects of Buddhist tradition. And that's why I think these passages are so striking, is because they actually speak of the self in a very affirmative way. Not the permanent, fixed, eternal self of the Atman, but you and me and him and her. That's where we work, both in terms of our inner work, in terms of our role in the world. It's all about you and me. And there's no problem. The Buddha doesn't problematize the use of the word atta, self. Of course, a very good, we'll come to this in the end. Now this also has, I'm running through this rather quickly, I'm afraid. I sometimes will give a whole talk just on that verse. But I think it should be clear for you. Just to reiterate, self is not a thing, self is not a state, there's no essence of me can be found anywhere. The self is in a sense unfindable. You can't find it within the body, you can't find it within the mind, you can't find it separate from the body and mind. So in that sense, self is profoundly elusive. In Madhyamaka philosophy, at least as I studied it in my training as a Tibetan monk, the self is ultimately unfindable. And that's what it means for it to be empty. The self is empty because it can't be found. In other words, you, no matter how long and arduously you probe into your experience, as I sort of hinted at in the meditation, the end of the meditation this morning. We have this conviction that, you know, of me, Stephen. I spend most of the day thinking about me. But when I actually try to pin that down, I find that there is nothing I can put my finger on. It slips away. There's a text attributed to Nagarjuna called the Ratnavali, the precious garland, in which he says it's like, you know, a man is in a desert, dying of thirst, and he sees in the distance an oasis with palm trees and camels, all that stuff, and he moves to heads towards it, only to find that the closer he gets, the more it evaporates. It's a mirage. And it's the same with our sense of self. We have a very clear sense of me, but as soon as we turn our attention to it, it vanishes like a mirage. You can't actually reach it. The Dalai Lama has a wonderful expression. He says, "Dzugu tsuksa mindu." There's nothing you can put your finger on. There's no finger-putting place. But the danger is we therefore conclude it doesn't exist. Because actually we'll find with everything, tables, chairs, houses, buildings, societies, elephants, when you look, when you ask yourself the question, but what is it really? You won't actually find anything. You'll just keep on going forever. You won't find something and you won't find nothing. You'll just find another set of conditions that can be explored yet further. It's similar in terms of, say, modern physics, where they're endlessly trying to find the ultimate particles of matter. And I know that this has been going on all my life, and it's still going on. Now, of course, the idea is that there are superstrings direction, the 11 dimensions of the universe or something. That's the latest theory, because every answer they come up with doesn't actually satisfy other conditions, the amount of dark matter in the universe or whatever it is. I think they'll probably never get to the ultimate particles of matter. I don't think these exist. Again, that's a very audacious thing to say for someone who doesn't know the first thing about physics. But my hunch is that this goes on forever. In the same way that if you explore and delve into the nature of who am I really, you won't arrive at nothing. You'll just keep on arriving at a different set of conditions which will allow you to pose that question again. I think there's a passage somewhere in William James's writings where he also introspectively tries to find the self. And in one passage he very interestingly says, all I come up with is a funny feeling in the back of the throat. And it's true, it's kind of weird. If you do this meditation, and I used to do it a lot when I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk, you know, we would systematically go through the body and the mind in meditation, trying to pin it down. And it's true. A lot of the time, the basis for me saying I is a funny physical feeling somewhere in the chest or in the tummy or in the throat or something. It's very weird. And you can just keep on going. There's no end to it. It really is another illustration of this middle way. The middle way between ati and nati. It is and it is not. He teaches the Dharma by the middle. Neither affirming nor denying, but allowing the possibility for a kind of infinite exploration. An infinite, and almost in a sense, an encounter with the infinite itself. So this is, but because we are like that, that means that we can change. That means we can transform ourselves. That means we can fashion ourselves like a piece of wood, or like an arrow, or a field. And for in the Gelugpa school of Tibetan Buddhism, that's also the definition of Buddha nature. Buddha nature is the emptiness of the person. The unfindability of the person is what enables us to have the potential to be a Buddha. There's no, unfortunately, Buddha nature has been co-opted in some schools of Buddhist thought to correspond to something kind of close to the Brahmanic Atman, some kind of essential Buddha-ness within us, the sort of struggling to get out. But in fact, at least in the Madhyamaka school, Buddha nature means the unfindability, the non-inherent the existent I or self. Because the self does not exist inherently, therefore it can become a Buddha. You can become a Buddha. You can become awake. I think that's a very important consequence of this kind of thinking. It's very much freeing us up for transformation. And of course, by implication, transformation of a community, transformation of a society. And I think that the Buddha had a two-pronged approach. He taught a way of personal transformation of freedom, and he also critiqued the social structure of his day and sought to envision another way of living in this world together. Unfortunately, that project failed. Buddhism ceased to exist in India, and I think the social and political implications of Buddhism were never really realized at all, possibly because the community was too identified with the Indian ascetic tradition, the renunciant tradition, and did not really have the kind of motivation to engage with social and political issues. It's another story. But now let's look at this in terms of our relationships to other selves. And there's two passages I want to look at here. The first one comes from the Sanyutta Nikaya, from the Kosala Sanyutta, the dialogues the Buddha has with King Pasenadi of Kosala, who's basically his overlord and his sponsor and his benefactor in the Jetta's Grove. Now on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had gone together with Queen Malika to the upper terrace of the palace. A little bit of context here. King Pasenadi is probably someone most of you haven't heard of. He's probably the most important lay figure in the Buddha's world. He's not only his sponsor, his patron, his benefactor. He's also a personal friend. And they are peers. They were born in the same year, so it's said. They died within a few months of each other. King Pasenadi, we know quite a lot about King Pasenadi. And one thing we know about him, he was a fat, bloated, overweight tyrant. He's often presented, the only time he's said to gain any effect from the Buddha's teaching is when the Buddha puts him on a diet. And he's very happy to be sort of nice. But he's never said to become a stream enterer or anything, which is odd, because usually that's fairly routine for the Buddha's followers. Pasenadi's a very quixotic and dangerous character. Now, Queen Malika was the daughter of the local garland maker, in other words, relatively low caste, whom the king marries. She's a very beautiful young woman, and this is this big kind of grotesque bloke. So on that occasion, King Pasenadi, of course, had gone together with Queen Malika to the upper terrace of the palace, and the king said to the queen, "Is there, Malika, anyone more dear to you than yourself?" In English we call this fishing for compliments. And Malika, who's considered to be quite a wise woman, says, "There is no one, great king, more dear to me than myself. But is there anyone, great king, more dear to you than yourself?" And then the king says, "Well, actually, for me, Malika, too, there's no one more dear than myself." So we're all selfish, self-centered creatures. Then King Pasenadi descended from the palace and approached the Buddha and related to him the conversation with Queen Malika. And then the Buddha recited this verse. "Having traversed all quarters with the mind, one finds none anywhere dearer than oneself. Likewise, each person holds himself most dear. Therefore, one who loves himself should not harm others." Now this, I think this is fascinating. The Buddha doesn't say, no, you know, holding yourself to be important, that's a very bad idea, you should try to be selfless and etc, etc. No, he doesn't do that. He says, yeah, that's the reality. Each living human person is primarily interested in themselves, in their own well-being. This he takes to be a given. And he's not saying you should stop trying to do that. He's saying that's just the way things are. But the conclusion he draws is rather surprising. He's saying, therefore, if you love yourself in this way, you should not harm others, because they, like you, wish to be happy for themselves, wish not to suffer for themselves. So when you, it's really an injunction to an empathetic relationship with the other, an acknowledging that all of us, in a sense, have the same primary yearning to be well, to be happy, not to suffer. And if you acknowledge that in all beings, then you recognize that they are the same as you, in the sense that, not they're identical to you, but they have exactly the same primary yearning as you do. So this strange reflection on self-centeredness is turned into the basis for a concern for others who are just like yourself in wanting to be happy and not wanting to suffer. Now, Shantideva, many centuries later, picks up on exactly the same idea and makes it into the basis for his teaching on bodhicitta, on the aspiration to be enlightened for the sake of others. It's all based on the same idea, the recognition of the equality of self and other. And this, I think, is very clearly the basis of one's ethical relationship to the other person. And of course, this means not just the, you know, that all of us in this little Buddhist group recognize we all have the same primary yearnings, but of course, for people we think of as the other. Mm-hmm. And each society has got its other. If we're Buddhists, we don't particularly, are not terribly keen on other religions, maybe. If we are Jews, we have the Arabs. If we are Chinese, we have the Tibetans, etc., etc. the whole issues of the other as somehow a threat to our well-being, which of course is what constitutes so much of our strife in our world. So in other words, to the first step perhaps to overcoming that sense of conflict and strife and antipathy and animosity is to contemplate and to recognize how each of us is equal in our primary yearnings as a human being, as a sentient being. You can extend this, of course, also to the animal realm as well, as the Buddhists would, as savasata, all sentient beings are like this. This is something, again, the Dalai Lama in his teachings is endlessly trying to get this idea home, because it's the foundation of that empathetic identity, the ability to recognize that yourself is much the same as myself, to see that there is an equality, a primary equality in what we seek, that is the basis of actually identifying with the other. And that's the basis for the way we treat other people. And this is said, I think, even more succinctly in a verse in the Sutta Nipata. I think I've mentioned the Sutta Nipata before. The Sutta Nipata is a collection of verses that is by Pali scholars said to probably be one of the earliest layers within the canon. This is largely ascertained by philological, in other words, by an analysis of the language. It's a very early form of Pali. So again, these, if it's in the Sutta Nipata, it carries some weight as going back to an early period of the Buddha's teaching. And here we find this verse, which we'll find, of course, also in other cultures. As I am, so are they. As are they, so am I. Comparing himself with others, he should not kill or cause to kill. Now this, of course, as you find it famously in the Gospels of the Christian tradition, do unto others as you would have them do to yourself. But apparently Rabbi Hillel said the same thing some hundreds of years before, or some period before. In other words, I think it is a basic human intuition. Is it?
It's one of the Ten Commandments, for instance.
No, I don't think so. Oh, no, don't kill, yes, but the love thy neighbour as thyself, I don't think is one of the Ten Commandments, is it?
No,
I don't think so.
Love
the
commandments.
Yeah, yeah, love your friends. And you, I think all you'll probably find all religious traditions will have this idea somewhere in them. It is so, it's such a primary insight.
It's actually more like this, it said don't harm the other. Al ta'aseh l'chaverecha ma she'sanu alecha. Don't do to the other what you dislike.
Yeah, to yourself, exactly. Well, that is almost almost identical to this. So again, I think it's silly to see this as some Buddhist thing or Christian thing. It's a universal human insight that appears in all cultures. And I think it's a very, very valuable, important thing to be brought home, to remember. And to remember it not just, you know, as a nice little saying, but again, I think meditation, mindfulness, awareness should extend to that reflection as well, you see. The more that we recognize, the more that we as it were, become more clear about our own deepest yearnings and longings, and we do that in a felt way through awareness, through meditation, through discussion, and we really bring that home, then I think the more we are going to be open to an acknowledgement of that same felt sense in other beings. And that, I think that's where the meditative practice, I think, bears home onto this primary ethical relationship. It's as I said, Ed, before, with the example we had, it's very easy to get the idea. I don't think anyone will dispute the idea. But how do we address deep emotional attachments and antipathies that are quite resistant to just being told, given some biblical text or something? how do we actually internalize and integrate this idea at a level where it becomes a felt sense rather than just a belief or a view? Yeah.
I think Freud said that this is in the religion because it's the thing that we're least likely to do, precisely because we are so interested in ourselves.
Yeah.
In this context, what is this? An injunction, a suggestion that this is the... It doesn't seem to follow logically that if I'm the most precious person to myself, I should be considerate of everyone else. In fact, it might follow logically that I should...
This is what I think is striking about the passage with Pasenadi, you see. It goes against common sense. But it's an entirely reasonable conclusion. In other words, he's taking a basic human feeling of self-centeredness and turning it against itself in a sort of jujitsu move, if you like. I think that's quite brilliant, frankly. It's quite extraordinary. But of course the consequences are, can we live this way? Can we actually relate to other people, all other people, not just with people we like? It's dead easy. You know, with our children and our families and our friends and our lovers, there's no problem. But the real challenge is with people that we don't like, that we feel threatened by. That's the challenge. And I think the Buddha was in a world which was as fraught with conflict as our own. When you think of this sort of statement in terms, say, of the traditional Indian way of dividing people into caste groups, you're basically setting up other, especially with notions of the dasi. India was at that time a slave society. The indigenous peoples of the Gangetic Plains were enslaved, and they were a very big other in that time. The Brahmins particularly defined the social codes according to untouchability, what sort of relations you can have with another, defined by law. Here you have a complete abandonment of any of those kinds of distinctions. And so this is a universal humanism. Possibly, I mean, he's speaking of it in humanist terms, but you could extend it also, as is implied elsewhere, to all living things. So I think the implications are broader than just our human relations, but probably we need, obviously that's very important for us. But nowadays I think we would particularly want to extend it to the actual, the biosphere itself, in a way. So again, as is obviously clear, if you don't have a notion of self, none of this will make any sense. So the idea there's no self is actually frankly absurd. And then to really sort of nail the point home, and to conclude what we're doing here this morning, I'm going to read out the very one of the very last and most famous passages that you find in the canon. And this is a statement the Buddha made about 3 months before he died. Again, we need to know the context. The Buddha's been very ill. He knows he's dying. His sangha is dispersed. He is basically just with a few close family members, Ananda, Anuruddha, and one or two others. He's aware that his homeland is being invaded by the armies of Kosala. He's not been able to gain any support either from Magadha or from the Vajin Republic, and he's now, after his last rains retreats, about to set off back to his homeland, Sakya. And again, which is, I think, very moving. It's the Buddha, an old man, he's 80 years old. His world is falling apart, it's breaking down into conflict and war. And this is what he says to Ananda. He says, "Therefore, Ananda, you should live with oneself as an island, oneself as a refuge, with no other refuge, with the Dhamma as an island, the Dhamma as a refuge, with no other refuge." And again, the word for self is atta. The Pali, you've got on the last page, you've got it. Atta dipa viharati, atta sarana, anyanya sarana, Dhamma dipa, Dhamma sarana, ananya sarana. It's very difficult, it's very, very concise in Pali. It just says, self, island, you live, self, refuge, no other refuge, Dharma island, Dharma refuge, no other refuge. So it's safe. Whereas in English it comes out as be an island unto yourself. And again, you see, they inflect the word self, be an island unto yourself. It's difficult to find the right, a simpler way to say it. But it disguises the fact that the Buddha is actually saying yourself is your refuge. There's no other refuge. But he then says, and again, sometimes that is quoted and taken to be a kind of 1960s hedonism, a do your own thing kind of. He's not saying that, because in the next sentence he says, Dharma Deepa, Dharma Sarana, Anyanya Sarana. The Dharma is an island. The Dharma is a refuge. There's no other refuge. Now again, we have to see this in context. The Buddha is about to die. The Buddha's on his way out. So he doesn't talk of taking refuge in the Buddha, which is again a standard thing. The Sangha is dispersed. He doesn't say take refuge in the Sangha. When the chips are down, what can you actually rely upon? Well, two things. The Dharma that is integrated into yourself. That's why he says there's only one refuge, the self, no other refuge. And then he says there's only one refuge, the Dharma, there's no other refuge. Well, that's a contradiction. It's either one or the other, surely. So in other words, I think the only way this can make sense is that it's that the Dharma integrated into your own life is in the end the only thing you can rely on. The Buddha's gone. The community's dispersed. In any kind of extreme situation where you find yourself alone, this could be when you're facing death, or you find yourself alone in, say, prison or in exile, which the Buddha's also finding himself at this point, you know, the only thing that's going to be of any real help is the extent to which you've internalized the Dharma into your own life. And then the Buddha says, and how do you do this, Ananda? Here, Ananda, a monk abides contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put aside all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise to the feelings, the mind, and Dhamma. And those who now in my time or afterwards live thus, they will become the highest, or they will reach their goals, let's say, if they are desirous of training or learning. It's a very powerful passage. One that bears endless reflection, and again which quite explicitly acknowledges that the reality of self, albeit understood in the way that we've explored this morning. Okay, so it's 20 to 1. We can have a short discussion, but I'd like to conclude with a sitting. So is there anything that has come up you'd like to discuss? Otherwise we can wiggle our legs and arms and then sit. Very good. Okay, so let's stand up
and stretch a bit.